Welcome, dear listeners, to another episode of Ahead of the Curve, where we say we get under the skin of the margin, collateral, and risk industry. My name is John Pucciarelli. I am head of industry and regulatory strategy here at Acadia. Along with me today is Stuart Smith. He is our co-head of business development here at Acadia. And we're going to be talking about three really interesting subjects. One is SIM, a 10-year look back and forward, Basel III Endgame, and FINRA 4210. I hope you enjoy this podcast, so let's go. We're going to talk a little bit about SIM. It was a groundbreaking effort by the industry and by ISDA. We're, I guess, 10 years on from that. It was implemented in 2016, but the white paper came out in 2013, so we are talking about 10 years, right? And I know you've written a lot about it. And then you have some stats to discuss. Where are we? How far have we come? Where are we? And really, what's the future of SIM?
I think if you go right back to the beginning, I remember sitting down with a colleague of mine, and he said to me, you know, this thing's going to change the industry. It's going to change the way we do things. It's going to change the landscape. And we've got to be there and present in it. Mm-hmm. And the winner of this is going to make a big impact in the industry. And I think we all were a little bit skeptical at the time. It felt like a small calculation alongside the bigger, harder things that we did.
Right.
But the reality is this thing is so big, it's so prevalent, done by so many firms, and a lot of firms who never did risk calculations before. It has changed the industry. It's brought many more vendors into the area. It's brought more calculation types into that, and it's pushed people in the smaller firms and buy-side firms to adopt kind of methodologies they've been putting off doing for a really long time. You know, today we've got about 600 firms who are actively managing and exchanging initial margin. Mm-hmm. There's another 600 who are sat in the monitoring phase, and that's people who are being actively monitored by their dealers. Mm-hmm. There could well be many more who've passed the ANA threshold, but are just sat there in self-monitoring and know where they are compared to that 50 million. Yeah. So there's no shortage of additional firms who may, you know, come on in the future. We tried to do a little bit of analysis to try and understand how quickly people are likely to breach threshold going forward. And we think, you know, based on the sort of tail of phase six, there's probably between another 100 and 300 firms that could breach threshold and start exchanging margin over the next 1 to 3 years. And that would bring, you know, tentatively close towards the 1,000 mark of firms who are daily exchanging initial margin.
Yeah.
I think that's, and if you ask people 10 years ago, I don't think anyone would have guessed it would be anywhere near that big. I think mm-hmm. that's a much, much bigger number of firms than people were expecting.
Yeah, I think I remember back, you know, for people who are listening, my background is I came from ISDA. I was there kind of in the early days of SIM. And I do remember a lot of the banks at the time, the tier one banks, the phase one banks, were really trying to get an idea of what the scope was going to be, not mm-hmm. just for phase one, the amount of, you know, new CSAs, new, you know, margin calls, et cetera, who's going to be doing it. And yeah, I think that number definitely was on different, you know, spectrums, depending on who you're talking to and who was doing the calculations. But now we have a much better idea. Mm-hmm. And I think just to reiterate for people who are listening and don't, maybe don't know or aren't familiar or need a reminder of the rules, that 50 million threshold, like you said, you could be above ANA, right, which brings you into the rules, but you're not moving margin if you're not above the 50 million. So, you know, that's interesting. I wonder, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but I know that there are instances where firms can come out of the rules as well.
Yeah.
Have we looked at any of that? I don't think that that's a big number, but I'm wondering if you've seen that at all. I personally haven't. I mean, we work in the same mm-hmm. company and we kind of touch a lot of the similar things. You know, I know that happens from time to time, but I would think that, you know, more people will be coming into scope than coming out of scope.
Yeah, I mean, coming out of scope is really complicated, actually.
Yes, it is.
I mean, if you redo your ANA calculation, find you're not in scope, the rules are a little bit, you know, distinct in geographies and things like that.
True.
I don't think we see a lot of firms who have maybe gone beyond the threshold, so are actually posting, who then come back out. Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things you do see, though, is we've been kind of look at how the exposure's grown over time as well as the number of firms. And what's really interesting is the exposure actually seems to have stopped growing, mm-hmm. Which implies that firms are being pretty smart about where they're placing trades and how they're trading, so that they don't see really big exposures and really big costly exposures today as well. You know, posting this margin has got much more expensive over the last last 2 years. Yeah. And we, you know, it's kind of hard to exactly explain that, but I think there's probably two big things that are going on. You know, one, buy-side firms and their dealers are working together to stay below the 50 million threshold. Mm-hmm. So we do see a lot of people hit the 50 million threshold, paper, and then hover around the 50 million threshold so they don't actually have to post. Mm-hmm. And then maybe bring on more dealers so that they've got more headroom to spread it across, which is actually really good for counterparty credit risk. It's stopping that concentration risk that you'd otherwise might get.
You think it's an unintended positive consequence, or it's just the nature of how things are evolving, really?
I think it probably isn't an unintended consequence, but I think it was probably obvious that would always be the case. You know, especially when posting margin gets more expensive. Okay. And the other thing I think is that can't be underestimated is the impact of optimization firms. Mm-hmm. You know, optimization firms, if you look before SIM, I couldn't really name an optimization firm that was, you know, very active before that point. Whereas now you can name 3, 4, and there seems to be more that sort of push into that area quite regularly. And I think SIM, again, that standardized data format that never existed before SIM, mm-hmm. that standardized way of describing what different firms are doing, enabled all those firms to come into that market and to make an impact. And I think certainly in the 1-4, the phase 1-4, so effectively the bank community, you know, I think that optimization is a key part of how they've stopped those margins increasing over time.
And that's pre-trade analytics as part of that?
Oh, pre-trade analytics is part of that, but then post-trade optimization from firms like Quantile, where they are, you know, actively pressing looking at, you know, what's the exposure, how can you reduce the risk across the industry by placing trades and manage people's margin proactively.
Yeah. It's very interesting to me that whole space. Have you said that, you know, it didn't really exist before, and now people are kind of taking a look at it. I would suspect that as, you know, firms are either breaching the 50 million or, you know, close to it, they're going to take a serious look. If they're not optimizing now, they're going to take a really serious look at doing it in the near future, right? But I do, you know, it is an interesting evolution of how, you know, the rules didn't even contemplate any of this this new business that was kind of thrust upon us. But it's going to be an interesting space to watch and how it's going to evolve over time. You know, just some thoughts from my end in terms of just thinking about SIM in general. You know, you talked about a colleague of yours saying that it was going to change the industry. I don't think anyone really knew what it was going to really do. Everyone was kind of focused in on how does an industry that really had a hard time agreeing on standards like this, we're going to get over that hurdle. And to me, that's always been the thing that stood out to me if I look back in hindsight about how almost miraculous that effort was. I think everyone understood that, and even working directly with the regulators as well. So it wasn't just a large industry that always had a very hard time agreeing on standards, but also working in conjunction with regulators and having a really great and open conversation across the globe. It wasn't just with you know, the UK and the EU and the US regulators, but everyone. It was a Herculean effort, and I don't think it should be underestimated.
No.
And I think it should be celebrated more because it really did ensure that this market, which is hundreds of trillions of dollars market in the OTC bilateral over-the-counter derivatives market, continued to thrive and survive and, you know, was still available for firms to hedge their risk.
And we're going to talk about it later, but you look at some of the commentary on Basel IV and they call out the exchange of initial margin as a key reason why you shouldn't hold as much capital anymore. Because the efficiency of the margin, the exchange of margin, reduces that risk by so much.
Right.
Why should we pay on top this capital charge as well when the credit risk has been mitigated?
Yeah. We'll get into a little bit of that.
Yeah.
All right, so that's SIM. Obviously, you know, we'll, as it's such a pillar of our business, I'm sure during a lot of these podcasts, we'll keep talking about more and more of it because it does change. Yeah. There is a recalibration, a new recalibration schedule coming. Shortly, so it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, and we'll probably be talking about that again. But shifting over to another regulation that is really focusing on in the U.S. mostly and impacting mostly large U.S. firms and their counterparties, but also non-U.S. firms who have who may be trading in other.
So I mean, I'm a not a 4210
expert. You're not a 4210 expert.
I'm not a US citizen, so that's probably why. Maybe you could take a step back for the rest of us and just explain a little bit what is 4210, why is it important, maybe even what's a TBA. Some of us, you know, if you're not in the US, these things aren't always obvious.
Yeah, to be announced. So these are CMOs, collateralized mortgage obligations, and adjustable rate mortgage products that a lot of US firms will trade. And they've been trading these things for a very long time. They've been collateralizing them for a very long time, but and there's, you know, there's an MSFTA, which is the governing legal document typically used. Doesn't have to be used, but that's kind of the market standard for firms to use for the margining of those products. We've never had a standard rule set before. It was proposed, I think, back in 2012 by FINRA, which is an arm under the SEC. And it's kind of it's been an interesting kind of ride because these rules were proposed again, kind of in the midst of the, you know, the post-crisis you know, rule setting exercise that UMR was part of. But this was specific to those products, and it was kicked down the road for a very long time.
Yeah, 2012.
Yeah, year after year after year. I think they finalized a majority of it in 2016, and they kept kind of adjusting it. Now, there was an IM component. I think that was a bone of contention for most, because I don't think that was ever really done in practice. Different than UMR, right? In the bilateral OTC world, there's concept of variation margin and IA or IM. Most people call it house IA. So there was that idea of an initial margin, extra layer of counterparty credit risk. In this market, not really. It's always been kind of variation margin, mark-to-market losses that you'd exchange collateral on. So, you know, that debate had raged, and they finally got rid of that component. So now it's just VM, and they finalized it the end of this year. They said, we're going to go ahead with these rules finally. May 22nd of this year, it's coming. So now firms, especially firms in the U.S., the banks, the larger dealers, and their counterparties who they trade with, are really focused in on this.
So is this impacting, so I guess, obviously the major banks, and what the smaller banks, and also onto the buy side as well?
Yeah, so anyone really trading these instruments will be affected by it. You know, and again, it's, you know, the numbers, we're kind of, you know, we're so at Acadia, there's a large effort now to kind of help those firms deal with it, move them into our, you know, our existing workflows to ensure that their STP rates don't go down, because that's obviously where we come in always, to make sure that, you know, straight through processing is always, you know, they're always achieving their numbers. But, you know, some indications are around, you know, 300 to 400 new margin calls, maybe even higher, depending. And, you know, in the thousands of new agreements, MSFTA agreements. So it's not a small undertaking. I wouldn't call it as large as, you know, the uncleared margin rules, but, you know, it is something that has to be dealt with. We are working very closely. We have a working group, and we are working very closely with our clients to help them understand and help them, you know, kind of, you know, get ready for these rules.
Yeah. And May 22nd is not very far away.
It is not very far away. You know, we only knew about this, and I think it was around December time, or maybe November time. Don't quote me. Somebody will watch this and go, no, he's wrong. It was October. So it was probably last quarter of last year where it was finally done. However, you know, FINRA had just had last week had a working group to go over a lot of Q&A. And one of the questions was, is this date moving again? Because it's moved so many times, like the boy who cried wolf. You know, and even up until last week, people still aren't sure or wanted to make sure that date was going to be a firm date. Yeah. So, you know, they have been pretty good, FINRA, and give credit to SIFMA to kind of help kind of gather the industry and FINRA to go through those questions. I think they've answered a lot of big ones in terms of, you know, is the date moving? No, the answer was no, the date is not moving. It's going to be May 22nd. And, you know, kind of all sorts of other things. The Q&A is actually, you can just do a Google search. We're going to link to it on our website as well, just so people can have access to as much information as possible. So Wow. That work's going to continue. That's going to be a big focus of mine.
Yeah, of course.
And our other colleagues internally as well. But that'll be an interesting one for sure. That's 4210.
Yeah.
More to come on that. Hopefully, we'll have like a nice successful, round of applause for the fact that we've gotten everyone over the line, and then we can kind of talk about real numbers and how it was affected, after May. So kind of shifting gears now away from that, we're going to talk about a topic that is really important for us in post-trade, and it's important to us across the board. Hmm. And it's something you and I have talked about on our last podcast, which is Basel III Endgame. Maybe just a quick reminder of what Basel III Endgame is. You don't have to define what a G-SIB is if you don't want to. But I know that there's been a lot of talk, especially in the U.S., and this is really, this is a global rule. But in the U.S., I would call it contentious.
Yeah.
Everything that I'm hearing, the rhetoric, I've watched kind of the hearings on Capitol Hill. Jamie Dimon has been outspoken about this in not a positive way. And one of the big things to me that came out of this very simply is like his big criticism is there wasn't enough data to substantiate the levels of capital that they're requiring firms to post. That said, where are we? So what are some of your thoughts on it? And are there any updates from the last time we spoke about it?
Yeah, so I mean, this just as overview, new capital rules. Yes, it's a global standard, and yes, it's the U.S. effectively catching up with the rest of the world on implementing these things. But also, they have chosen to gold plate those rules to make them more stringent, to make them more firm, and more costly. And that's in a large part where the U.S. industry is pushing back. But that pushback almost feels so strong that they could even reject the entire package. Mm. And it's worth realizing that would leave us in a very peculiar position where we, for the first time in a really long time, haven't got a global approach to how we manage these type of risks. Fascinating. That vote is going to be crucial. And I think, there's bound to be a few twists and turns between now and when that happens as to how that goes. There was a really great sort of set of feedback from ISDA and SIFMA in terms of why they think that this is excessive and where they think it's excessive and how it can be improved. I think they pointed out the fact that the US already has a more stringent G-SIB rule means they're already posting more margin in the US than the rest of the world. So in some ways, then adding on another rule which pushes it even higher is kind of unfair in the other direction. On the market risk side, really there was a push to say post-crisis, and I think everyone remembers the feeling post-crisis, 2008, 2009, we don't trust the banks. Mm-hmm. They're roulette wheeling.
They did until that time.
Yeah. And, we're going to put some really harsh rules against them. Yeah.
Counterparty credit risk was only for the smaller end users, not the big guys.
Yeah.
Right? And then everything changed.
And they said, well, okay, you're not going to have the right to do this fancy modeling anymore. You're going to have some basic models that are going to be safe.
Yeah.
And those models are really basic and don't account for a lot of diversification and hedging and things that you can do to offset risk. And that was kind of passed in other jurisdictions back in that feeling of, that's what the banks need. They need a simplification. Mm-hmm. Whereas now, in a higher interest rate environment, in a tougher economic cycle, those look like they're going to be quite punitive. They probably always were. But now I think the feeling amongst people is they're more punitive and going to limit business more.
So just to stop you there really quick. Mm. And again, I know I always caveat and say, I don't want to put you on the spot. But I think it's an interesting thing that just popped in my head. So you mentioned that in the U.S. it's more stringent. Mm. Versus the rest of the world.
Yeah.
The rest of the world, as far as I can remember, there wasn't a lot of vocal opposition to this, or was there? Like, so in the EU, did you hear a lot of the same arguments? Was it because that it wasn't as stringent? It was kind of like, all right, maybe these capital rules and the standards are okay, and we can deal with them. So I guess that's why I always ask the question, like, why is this happening now? I knew the U.S. was late to the game, but why is the U.S. only like saying all these things? Like, there isn't enough data. It's a sledgehammer. It's not accounting for everything else that we're doing in terms of like ensuring that there's enough capital in case the, you know, in case a bank goes under.
No.
One of the things I heard, though, and I don't know if this is true, but is part of the rule saying that, you know, they have to have, you have to have enough capital for every depositor in a bank? I think I've heard that before. I could be wrong, and I don't want to go off on a tangent, and you don't have to answer that. But I did hear that, and maybe we can go back and fact check that at some point. But anyway.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a whole bunch of things in there. I mean, one, you know, we're late to the game, and that means a couple of things. One, we actually understand the rules much better than we did when they were passed elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And certain things around the market risk side, which were, everybody always spoke, and there's a lot of talk at conferences, this is going to be really hard. Now realize this is completely impossible and it's just not going to work. So in some ways, a lot of that chat that was going on, which didn't really get any political attention at the time, is now much more known, much easier to present, and, you know, and has managed to capture the sort of the attention in the US, in the politicians and of the public, which is completely different to what happened elsewhere. So I think, you know, that kind of that lateness, that the fact the model's better known, and the fact that we're in this very different economic place to where we were in 2013, 2014,
yeah,
I think it combines to really put you in a different place.
Yeah, I think that's probably the key, right?
It's,
we didn't have the inflationary and the interest rate pressures that we're having, that we've been seeing over the last couple of years. So, yeah, it's probably one of those things that we're reacting and saying, look, you know, the you know, the price of a can of Coke is going to triple or quadruple or something like that. And we already have a lot of global economic things happening, unrest, supply chains still not where it was post-COVID. This is just kind of adding another layer. It's going to be really interesting to see if, you know, we have an election. There's an election coming up. I know we're here in LSEG in London. I know we're talking a lot about what's happening in the United States, but there is a election in the U.S. coming this year in 2024. That includes Congress and the executive branch. It's going to be interesting to see how that all plays out. We're definitely going to have to talk about this again at some point.
And I would assume that we'll see a vote on this before the election.
Before
cycle.
That, yeah, you would, yeah, we hope so.
And you know, that's, I mean, it's just fascinating how that could play out, right?
Yeah.
You know, an approval and a kickback from the American voter against, you know, these rules, or a rejection and the rest of the world turning around in the morning going,
yeah,
what the hell, you know?
Right. And they, you know, so, like, either way, it doesn't sound like a great outcome either way. Either, you know, if it goes through, all the concerns that folks in banking are expressing now to Congress, how is that going to play out? And if they reject it, how is that going to affect global trading with firms who are already subject to these rules versus if the U.S. firms aren't? Is that going to create an unfair you know, playing field? How does that get resolved? Maybe the global community has to come back again and kind of revisit this. Maybe that would be the outcome.
I mean, two specifically interesting bits. So counterparty credit risk. Interestingly, the one area where we've seen virtually no pushback at all. So minor changes being requested to the SACA method, but the fact that the internal model method has been removed, people seem fine with that, which is a surprise, given that that's a really significant chunk of the capital. But yeah, I mean, it appears that SACA really is the way forward and will be the dominant measure across the globe. On the market risk side, you know, the one thing that we've really seen, the IMA, the internal model approach, has been well known, has been extremely hard to pass for some time. I think quantitatively we know just how hard it is to pass.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons for that is that you need to be able to match those risk valuations with all the limitations of risk systems and modelable risk factors with front office valuations. And all of the studies that have shown this is incredibly hard for anything but the simplest, most liquid of instruments.
Mm-hmm.
And there seems to be a real groundswell across the globe to say, this should no longer be a quantitative measure and metric by which we get kicked out of this capital saving regime. This should be a qualitative metric which forms a discussion with the regulator, and we agree whether over time we need to move in and out of using the standardized or the internal model. And that seems to be, I've heard it in so many places now, that seems to be something that I think may be considered as a way of allowing people to get more into the capital saving areas that they're currently probably going to be excluded from.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we don't profit from pain, but things like this sound like it's painful. And I know that, you know, it becomes a challenge, and whatever happens, you know, obviously it's always something that we're going to examine to make sure that, you know, we're in a place where we can work and partner with our clients to help them. But, you know, from a broader perspective, this is a really interesting one. I think there's a lot of what's to come. There's some drama. And, you know, this is one of those topics that I'm really interested to kind of keep my finger on. And with that, like I said before, I probably said this a million times already. We'll definitely come back, hopefully it's in the studio, because this is a really nice studio. And we'll see where we are. You know, May's going to be a great month for 4210. There's also T+1 that we're not going to talk about that's happening in the U.S. as well. So there's a lot going on this year. There's a ton. Anything else before we close?
No. I mean, I think that's a great intro to the year. I mean, there's some topics that we're going to keep running in there. And look forward to talking about them through the rest of the year.
Yeah, well, 2024 should be very, very interesting. Stuart, thank you very much for joining today. We'll be back again. And, you know, Basel III Endgame will still be on the agenda, I'm sure, as there'll be other things to discuss as well. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you all for joining this episode of Ahead of the Curve. We hope you enjoyed it. I know I did. If you are interested in hearing other podcasts, you can visit our website at acadia.inc, or you can find us on any of your favorite streaming services. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you again soon.